everybody. Welcome. Welcome here to show 84 on Crypto Voices. Matthew Majinskas, your host here from Latvia. Releasing this on January 9th, it marks the third anniversary of Crypto Voices. And of course, as is also becoming tradition, my tremendous co-host Fernando Ulrich just can't be bothered from the beach this time of year down in Brazil. So it's just me today. But in his place, we have another wonderful Brazilian Bitcoiner back on the show for the second time, Rodolfo Novak. Rodolfo is a Bitcoin entrepreneur from Brazil, now based in Toronto. Hence, you know, he's actually working right now, not on the beach. He's in the Northern Hemisphere. Rodolfo has founded a variety of interesting projects in the Bitcoin world, from BTC Look, CoinKite, OpenDime, and last but certainly not least, the ultra-secure Bitcoin hardware wallet, the Cold Card. So very happy to have him on the show for our third year anniversary special. Rodolfo, welcome to the show. Thanks for joining.
Thanks for having me. Too bad Fernando had his thong melt into the chair and was not able to get back to the microphone.
Indeed, indeed. Yeah, too many cocktails with an umbrella in them, I'm sure. He'll eventually get back to work there. Although, as you said, maybe it's not until after Carnival for some Brazilians in January, February.
Oh, I'm sure he's just rereading everything that he can about base money between now and the end of Carnival.
Absolutely. I think we can never get enough talk on base money on this show, as you like to hold our feet to the fire there. Very happy happy for that, my friend. Listen, buddy, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. Yeah, happy 2020.
Absolutely. New decade, new 10 years coming here for Bitcoin. You were actually our fifth guest on the show back in 2017. And, you know, that was a time when we really couldn't get anyone good on the show.
Thanks.
Going on in Bitcoin. And so it was great. It was really great to have you on then, though. It's great to have you on now. What's going on, man? What are you thinking about here in the start of 2020?
I think it's a good time to start a new Bitcoin foundation. Really need it. So I think Nakamoto is the name I'm thinking of using.
What are your thoughts on the Nakamoto Telegram group / movement / special website?
I love crypto anarchy. You know, it kind of makes me happy that, like, those things happen, because that's literally what Bitcoin is about, is people just being able to start whatever they want, but also us all be able to shit on whatever we want. So it's fantastic.
Yeah, it really is. People got to stop being so serious about everything all the time. Just like the Golden Globes last night, right? I saw some...
Yeah, I don't really follow any of this stuff, but it was doing the rounds. I couldn't help myself. I watched the 7 minutes, you know. It was crazy.
I think I saw the same, yeah.
Oh, it was just so good. You guys know, you guys went to school for less than Greta. You shouldn't talk about anything. Oh, man. It's been an interesting few weeks of in the Twitter space with Bitcoin and popular culture. There's nothing like acts of war over Twitter and like Bitcoin foundations, and it's always entertaining, never boring.
Certainly, from the slapstick to the serious, considering the military action that Trump took against Iran recently. But I don't want to change. I don't want to pivot too much there. But I do want to actually get back a little bit into what is going on for you these days at OpenDime, at Cold Card. Seems like you guys have had quite a good year.
Yeah, I mean,
presentation you gave at Honey Badger.
Yeah, that was fun. Presenting Mark III, our new version of Cold Card. We had a great time in Riga. You definitely show to me how you guys drink in Riga.
That might be like too good here, buddy.
It was very entertaining. I will definitely make the track there again.
It was great. It was great to meet you in person.
Yeah, we had a fun time there. That conference is quite good. I mean, it's nice to have all the Euros and the crowd that you normally don't get in North America there. Also, a lot of users. There were interesting presentations. I really enjoyed Honey Badger. It was a shame I couldn't go the year prior. I had to be in the delivery room for a baby.
Yeah, absolutely. Congrats on that. That was just around, I believe, the 1 year birthday then of your.
That's right. So we launched Cold Card Mark III, which had, you know, like has a ton of security improvements, a more modern secure element, and all kinds of good stuff. What else? We launched OpenDime version 4 that has sort of like better ESD protection, things like that. We've been selling a ton of cold cards. People seem to really like it. Which is always fun, and it does incite some ire in some of the competition, which makes for very interesting and dramatic Twitter exchanges. Never boring.
Anything in particular come to mind?
Well, there is the guys from that company that had the first hardware wallet was totally pound, and then the second one had some issues too, and I think they just had another pound on their wallet too, but they seem to be very interested in leveraging our marketing for their purposes through nice PR. But I find that the best punishment is to just not mention their name, and then they die in obscurity.
Well, yeah, I mean, obviously, you and your colleagues over in Canada have, I think, from the beginning been quite deep in the open source ethos of hardware development, well before Cold Card.
Yeah, I mean, and OpenDime. CoinKite is older than Trezor. I mean, we've been in this space before pretty much all these guys. We were making hardware security modules for our web services back then. It was fairly natural transition for us to make it for the consumers. But it was more sort of like based out of a passion project than an actual commercial project. It became a commercial project.
It is interesting, in all seriousness. I mean, I've seen some of your tweets saying, you know, you're not a startup. You're trying to, you know, scratch your own itches before you necessarily want to put some certain risks out there, perhaps to the consumer that you see, so on and so forth. So I don't know, what would you say you've been doing differently? We could just lay it out there for our listeners compared to the likes of a Ledger or a Trezor or other hardware wallets.
Yeah, so I mean, Cold Card is based on a very different architecture, right? So Trezor is a very sort of like crude project based on a general purpose microchip, right? So that doesn't really offer any security. It's like zero security. What it does is it segregates the signatures, private key from your computer, right? So it does. So essentially, the security model there is it's not in the computer. The computer is all owned, right? So that helps a lot. It really does. Ledger, on the other hand, has an actual secure device. But it's fully closed source, and you know, I just simply cannot make myself use a closed source hardware wallet because you don't know what's running in there. As simple as that. So we started, you know, I really wanted for myself an open hardware wallet that uses a secure element. It was just so obvious to me that, you know, that's the model that we wanted. And, you know, we learned a few tricks with OpenDime, and we sort of like developed this architecture where you do have a secure element and you do have an open architecture. So you get best of both worlds. And the secure element that we have is fixed function, right? So like there is no, you set its settings, but there is no actual code running in there, right? It's very dumb. So it's a very dumb, very secure storage for your key. And then when you need to do any Bitcoin operations, you're using open source software that's available on GitHub for everybody. You can even load your own firmware on an MCU. And this gives you a lot of essentially like free security because of the architecture itself. And you know, I needed something that would satisfy a very sort of paranoid, view of security, right? Like right. sort of
like a very crypto, like a cypherpunk sort of look into how to develop a device, right? So, you know, you have all this sort of layers of security, sort of security in depth, right? To keep things at a next level and still remain open. You know, we have the security bags and we have anti-phishing words and we have bricking, and there is quite a lot to it. I think a lot of...
proxy over the element.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and the keys is clear so you can inspect it. And the list really goes on. You can see all the addresses the device generates in the device. You can use it, most importantly, completely air-gapped, right? So you don't have to connect it to a computer ever. You can just use it with a battery. It was really an exercise in ticking off all the boxes, right, for the things I wanted in a device. And I wanted buttons because I hate that screen.
I was actually a cold card user from your very first one, which...
That was rough.
Let's say it's grown a lot since then. You had some improvements over the years. Specifically, the clicky buttons was a big one. This is actually one of the questions I want to ask you, definitely broad. Like, what would you say is sort of the biggest technical thing that you've learned over the years, like technologically building something that's supposed to be extremely secure? What's like the biggest technical challenge?
I think it's... you know, being an open source project means it's much easier for security researchers to poke holes at your device, right? Because they can literally go read the bug in your code. when you do have security by obscurity, right? So you have a closed source project, it is harder for researchers, right? It also means there's less eyes on your code. So it's not a very clear trade-off, which is more secure if it's open source or closed source. I think the open sourceness, to me, is less of a more or less secure battle, as more as it is verifiable to me that this device is not doing any funny shenanigans with my key generation and key signing. That to me is the most important, right? So I can trust that when this device generates a private key for me, it's doing what it says it does, right? It's not creating this over a rainbow table or something that somebody else could come and sort of have a backdoor into the cryptography of the device itself. I think that to me is one of the most important things. And I think we really sort of kicked the bucket into the air on that one by just... not even though it's open and you can sort of verify everything, I think that the next level really is what we did, which is you can throw dice and not trust the device at all. So you can use dice as the source of entropy to generate your own private keys. And offload all the trust, really. It's very trust minimized. There is no such thing as trustless, but... he really takes these things to the next level their way. I think that was sort of like the lesson that we've been learning and sort of like taking as the path. It's how to trust minimize as much as possible.
Yeah, and it's a wonderful, I mean, ethos. You can just tell when you read the docs, when you go through the device, you can just see that it's definitely built from the ground up, like completely with security in mind, much more than, you know, having some companion app or whatnot. The BIP 174 partially signed Bitcoin transaction, that's really, really easy to do on the cold card. Is it the only hardware wallet that conveniently offers building a partially signed Bitcoin transaction?
As far as I know, it's the only hardware wallet right now that supports BIP 174, or at least the main ones. It was built, the device was built around BIP 174 as its user experience, right? So it was really meant for you to be able to shuffle through the transactions that way, right? So you take the partially signed transaction from Core or Electrum or Wasabi into the device to sign and then take it back out as a transaction just to broadcast. I think that's a game changer. I remember back, way back in the CoinKite days, we used to support all the main hardware wallets for multisig. We're the first people to do that. And, you know, each of them had their own libraries and complications on how they take transactions to be signed and all that stuff. And aside from all the issues in handling all that stack, it's just more crap to have bugs. I like the idea of the actual wallet, right? The computer wallet that's state aware, right? That knows the UTXOs to create a transaction for you to sign. I want these wallets not to know which hardware wallet I have, right? So if a remote attacker is trying to do something, he doesn't even know which hardware wallet I have. That to me is a huge win already. And I want the segregation to keep on getting further and further, right? So as other hardware wallets eventually integrate PSBT, maybe they're going to be able to do what we can, right? So you can create a multi-sig wallet between code cards without touching a computer, right? The code card generates the first setup script, and then you set it to the next one via microSD card and the other one, and then you have a quorum setup. So eventually, other hardware wallets are going to be able to just participate in a multi-sig setup also without touching a computer, right? That would be pretty powerful.
Absolutely. This is a question I had, maybe a dumb one, I'm not sure, but this sort of managing of transactions and even backing up with the microSD card, what are some of the risks around that? Like one, for example, one option is you can actually back up the cold card wallet itself onto a microSD. When you select that option, if you do that, if you back up the cold card onto a microSD, to me, it seems like then there's some sort of hot element that you've put on that SD card. What are you doing when you're backing up the cold card onto a microSD?
Yeah. So that was one of my sort of wish list features, right? I always wanted... So here's the problem, okay? When you make a backup of a hardware wallet, right? You the only thing you can really do safely is write on a piece of paper, right? Because if you want to encrypt your backup, you'd have to put in a computer to make the encryption. And that computer is owned. So now you just expose your private key to a computer. What's the point?
Right.
So what we did, though, is you already trust the hardware wallet to see the private key, right? It's sitting in the side of the device. So what we do is we encrypt your seed inside the hardware wallet, and then we put that encrypted seed into a microSD card. And then we give you the 12 words that we used as a password for the encrypted microSD. So there is nothing hot, there is nothing clear text on the microSD. The microSD is fairly safe because it's been encrypted.
When you say fairly safe, is there some attack vector possible with that? Because it's still, even though it's encrypted...
Well, it is 12 words, so it's a lot of entropy. So 12 words is quite a bit of entropy. It's a lot. And then if you also have a passphrase on top of that, now good luck, right? Because they would have to first brute force 12 words of the microSD. They would get a seed. And then once they have the seed, they'd also have to guess the passphrase, which is maybe another 128 bits. So it really like at an next level here. I think the microSD cannot, like the encrypted microSD is a very good backup way. Because see, let's say you have a hardware wallet and you make your paper backup, right? That's clear text. Where do you put that?
Depends. I don't want to dox myself right? on my strategy, but many people have, yeah,
of course.
Strategy to keeping those things safe.
Sure. You know, it's under a lake somewhere, right? Or under the sea. So So if it's under the sea, great. Now, how do you retrieve that? What if somebody finds it, right? Now, they have the whole thing. If they find a micro SD, they still have to break up a lot of stuff, right? I still believe people should have clear text backup somewhere. It's very important. But having more accessible encrypted backups is very useful, right? Because the more inaccessible your clear text backup is, the better it is, right? Because you can't just be put a gun to your head and then go get it, right? Ideally, you have a setup in a way that you can't get it. So your encrypted, though, could be more accessible, but the password for the microSD is more inaccessible. So then, you know, you sort of now have two factors there, right? Because you need physical access plus password. So if you need to restore a dead hardware wallet, you don't have to go retrieve your clear text one. It's important to build layers. And passphrases are always a good thing, too.
Yeah, I actually haven't gone through with that process. So are you saying that the microSD, you have the sort of 12-word seed that encrypts your actual 24-word seed?
Yeah, it's not a seed. It's a password.
12-word password.
Yeah, so it's a 12-word password to decrypt the seed. And we use SHA-256 CBC, pretty fairly good standard.
And what would be some of the use cases for having that microSD, lying around, which is encrypted, backed up version of your seed?
Well, lying around is a very big, I wouldn't say lying around, right? But you would be, say, geographically removed from you. So let's say your house catches on fire, right? Like your office is on fire and you know, like your actual hardware wallet is gone, right? So you need to remake that. Instead of going after your paper backup, that's very hard to get. You buy a new code card on the store, you send it to your house, you stick the microSD in, and you go retrieve your password from whatever other country you keep in. And you're good, right? You have your setup back in business. It's about being back in business fairly quick, but not being coercible. Because, say, if your password or microSD are in a different country, right? You make it hard for a $5 wrench, right? They'd have to, I don't know, like very hard to cross a border with somebody with a gun to your head, right? And then you'd have other factors, right? Maybe, you know, maybe this is part of a multi-sig. So, you know, your cosigner is not willing to cosign, you know, if you have that wrench pointed at you. Especially in a multi-sig scenario, having good backups that are not just paper, that have the proper configuration scripts, that have everything, is a huge win, right? Because I always like to say the majority of the people, the great, great majority of the people don't get hacked. They screw themselves out of their coins by making a mistake.
That was a point I think you made very clearly and at Honey Badger, and I think many in the space have done that as well. It's important to keep in mind. Probably safe to say the vast majority of people that have lost coins, frozen coins, have just done it through their own, either being ill prepared or maybe even being overly complex. So there is a balance there, isn't there, for sort of the average person to try to get it right?
Yeah, and I think there's also different needs. Like a single person will also have different needs, right? So you're going to have your operational wallet. You're going to have your pocket change wallet. You're going to have your savings wallet. You're going to have your business wallet, right? And each of those will have different security requirements. I think it's important for people to learn how to keep funds segregated. So UTXOs are not mixed between things that they shouldn't mix. Don't use vendor wallets that send your information. So for example, you know, hardware wallet makers will have their easy to use wallet on the computer, well, those are doxing all your coins to the vendor. They may not be nefarious, but you don't know who's watching. So keep your coins private. And the other thing is use things, you know, air-gapped. You know, keep things offline. That was the main reason for us to make CodeCard the way it is. It's like, if you're not connecting a device to a computer, it's a lot harder to hack it.
Yeah, and I think this leads me to my next question sort of regarding the social challenges of dealing with regular security hardware and also open source hardware security, kind of in light of what I asked before about the sort of the technical challenges that you've learned. But obviously, I'm sure you've dealt with many, many clients directly and indirectly over the past few years. What are some of like the biggest social challenges of sort of, you know, you used the word crypto anarchy earlier. I mean, trying to make this, again, I don't know the right word, sort of good enough for most of your clientele, most of your customers. What are sort of the biggest social challenges that you've sort of learned and seen?
So I think we have a different approach, and this question will become a little bit more clear. It's we don't build for the lowest common denominator, right? Say like Coinbase or Ledger, like those guys would sort of, they're more ideal, and Trezor in a way is going the direction too. They sort of aim to be easy first,
right?
And then sort of powerful security second. We start from a different premise. For us is how can I make the best secure hardware wallet and then keep it as simple and stupid as possible. So what you get out of that may not look like it's easy, may not look like it's straightforward because, you know, looks scary. You have features, you have things you can do. But because we kept it simple, once people try a couple times, they learn, right? It's like kind of like a bicycle in that way. It may look like a complex device when you're a kid, but then once you get on it and you try a couple times, it just becomes so natural. We try to design our things that way. Same with OpenDime. They may have a more complex look to them, but they're not. And the issue with making things oversimplified is that if you're abstracting the functions too much, you give a bigger gap for social engineering and for all the social problems you'd have, right? So, for example, if you're using a vendor wallet for your hardware wallet, now you have to be concerned about which fork they're going to follow, right? That's a social issue. If you're using Core, if you're using Electrum, well, you don't have to worry as much, right? If you're using your own node, that's your own problem. So I think trying to remove the social attacks from that perspective, even though it takes a slightly bit more initial investment in knowledge, really pays off much better, I think.
And I think that's obviously one of the core principles of Bitcoin, if there is such, is that it's really trying to decentralize down to the local level, you know, making sure that all of this validation and verification can be done, you know, at low cost locally. And that's definitely in line with that. Where do you see though, you know, the other side going?
That's the ethos.
Yeah, it is the ethos. Absolutely.
Oh, I mean, this is the ethos, right? I mean, what's the point of using, I mean, you know, in reality is if you're not running your own node, you're not doing Bitcoin.
Right.
You're just outsourcing your validation. That means you have signing power, but you have no consensus power, right? And if you're using custodial, then you have no signing power nor consensus power. So,
nor privacy.
But if you're using somebody else's node, you have no privacy either, right? So when you're using Ledger, Trezor, like easy to use wallet on the computer, if you're using their backend, you have no privacy. So there is so much easy you can get without losing something, right? And I think we should keep on pushing for people to learn, because if they don't learn, they're not going to do Bitcoin right, and they're going to be somebody else's passenger, right? We want to slowly. And reality is most people in the world will keep on getting screwed even with Bitcoin, right? If they're not being screwed by the central banking policies, they're going to get screwed by custodial Bitcoin services. And that's just the natural order of things in the world. There's so many people you can save. The idea is to try to save as many as we can, right? I mean, that's the hope. That's the glass half full there is, you know, anybody that's willing to put knowledge or has the time or the means now has a choice at least or an option that was not available before, right? It's just ludicrous to me that anybody who's educated enough to say no to central banking and want to do Bitcoin is not running their own node for their own self-validation, right? Because what's the point?
Right.
So I really hope that, you know, we keep on instilling that, and vendors that do offer validation services or custodial services, you know, try to push their users to do Bitcoin right. You know, like, it's okay to use the custodial service, you know, for your first few cents, right? Just get them to slowly understand each step of the way and keep on moving off into self-sovereignty, financial sovereignty. That's the goal.
I was just listening to our interview a couple of years ago. You said the exact same thing. If you're not running a full node, you're not doing Bitcoin. So... nothing but principled consistency coming from you, my friend. I don't know about principled.
You know, it's
consistent at least.
Yeah, that's right. It's not me, right? This is just what Bitcoin is. I think I'm just being a vehicle here for regurgitating what the consensus software says.
And what do you think then about the other side? I started to ask this earlier, but what do you think about the other side then that is catering to the masses? We our last show was with Trace Mayer. He was going around to many podcasts, touting proof of keys, very good message. But still, you know, as we know, most people will not validate, not run their own node, and even just, you know, leaving a few coins on an exchange makes them think that they own Bitcoin. And again, Cryptopia last year, Quadriga, these hacks and centralized exchanges just keep running into problems. You think it's just going to be a slow grind, or is there anything more, I don't know, optimistic or pessimistic for you now that we're 11 years in here to Bitcoin?
So I'm optimistic on the side that, you know, there's a lot more tools, there's a lot more options. There is a lot more for you to be self-sovereign with Bitcoin, right? You really can choose your level of sovereignty you want, and you know, it's going to keep on improving, and more people do it, and less people get screwed. But as Bitcoin grows more, right, like the pie gets much bigger, the exit scams will become much bigger as well, and a lot more people get screwed. And that's just, again, the natural order of things, right? It's an unfortunate human condition that laziness prevails. Unfortunately, but for traders, there really is no other choice, right? They have to keep coins in exchanges so that they can trade on movement. But I hope, my hope is that people that don't need to trade, you know, we'll slowly move off of exchanges, and I think that will slowly happen. It's always going to be just a standard ratio, and I don't know what the ratio is right now, but I don't think that ratio is ever going to change. The percentage of people that keep things custodial versus non-custodial, but both will grow a lot.
Yeah, and probably the custodial part will get better. Whether it's, you know, something like proof of reserves or just general sort of security practices, improving. But you never know. I mean, at the end of the day, there's still so many centralized features there that can, well, are more vulnerable to be hacked than if you do it yourself.
Right. Well, I mean, centralized systems are more efficient, right? There are decentralized exchanges, but they're not efficient. They're becoming better, but they'll never be efficient.
Maybe with Liquid BTC, you could have order books that are decentralized, but that's a whole other mess. It's still very far away from what we have now in terms of being able to compete with an exchange that's centralized.
But it's all good. I mean, even big exit scams and big things like that still bring Bitcoin to mass media, right? And gets attention to it. So it's not a net. So it's still like there's still some gain out of it. Any press is good press, right?
Yeah.
And I mean, I used to push Bitcoin more onto the average person, but I don't do that anymore. I think we've crossed that window, that milestone in Bitcoin. I think now it's more like, you know, we should sort of help the people who want to be helped in terms of improving their security, their self-sovereignty, and let everybody else come to their conclusions eventually, right? I mean, I'm just curious to see how far the party in like 1999 is going to keep on happening in the stock market. And, you know, we have this very weird bond market right now. Everything is weird.
As but we have it seems to years. Keep on.
Yeah, I know, right? But it keeps on going.
Yep.
But, you know, at least in Canada, for example, we have, you know, the effective inflation is insane. I mean, you know, food is doubling price every 2 years, right?
There's no inflation, Rodolfo. There's no inflation.
There's no inflation, right? There is no inflation. our public transport keeps on increasing. Like, it's fascinating, right? Because
healthcare, education,
everything. People are paying. Like, I mean, kids like can't afford to like do stuff, even having a job. So,
but there's no inflation. Just remember,
there is no inflation. It's a very clever setup that they have now. They are able to do the bail-in and you know, through repos and QE. It's just an interest, negative interest rates. It's fascinating. It truly is. These guys are not dumb.
It's an old game, and they're experts in the space for sure.
Yep.
What about privacy then? Even if you don't look at Bitcoin, you just look at more traditional financial services. I mean, over the last decade, Capital One, Home Depot, Yahoo, Target.
They hate the professional ladies.
Bank of America. Yeah, I mean, the list goes on and on and on. But
yep.
The funny thing is, like, people are losing their data all the time. IDs, credit card numbers, financial info, addresses. They lose them all the time. But, you know, the world keeps ticking along. And at least in the developed world, that is like just seems to be a risk that people are willing to take and even accept if it goes wrong. Do you think Bitcoin will be a paradigm shift in privacy, or do you think it will not really change?
Well, I mean, most people don't care about their privacy, right? They have Facebook accounts.
Yeah.
the thing is, one is asymmetrical issue here, right? Because, you know, most people don't have identity loss issues when Bank of America loses their information, right? Like, most customers are not going to have their credit wrecked, right? It's going to be a small percentage.
Right.
And from that small percentage, some of them will get some money back through the bank paying for it because of PR. Some of them are just too poor, so they won't even be able to make any noise. So, you know what I mean? It's a wash, right? It's like Equifax loses all this data. You know, it turns out that the world keeps on going, right? Mostly because of that, things don't change. What Bitcoin really helps right now, in the future it will be different, but right now, because Bitcoin is a much bigger pain in the ass to use than a credit card, you help the people who actually need as opposed to want, right? So if you need to skip capital controls, then your privacy, your financial privacy matters, right? Your fungibility matters. So having a pile of USD in cash in Argentina or Bitcoin solves your problem. You're going to go through that to do it. I really still don't quite get why the pot industry in the US doesn't go Bitcoin instead of cash. It's not clear to me. Because it seems to make sense, but it probably missing something. That's why they're not using it. The same with the sex worker industry. And then there is a porn industry in the US too that doesn't seem to really be catching on with Bitcoin. Don't get it because they keep on getting debanked.
Yeah, and that's always a colloquial thing, is that the, you know, Playboy and the porn industry was the first to online payments and digital payments and privacy, you know, back in the day. I speak from hearsay, of course.
Right.
But that was always the thing. And you're right, it hasn't quite seem to catch on in both of those industries. And
I think it's because the problem is mostly on the merchant side. Customers don't really give a crap anymore if their credit card says that they like some porn site or whatever, right? I mean, it's porn has been completely normalized. So I think that's it, right? It's like nobody cares. But on the merchant side, merchants can still get merchant solutions for their porn sites. It's just that they will find merchant solutions that are a bit more expensive, right? That the merchant provider is a higher cost, higher risk type. But it seems that cost is still good. And then there is the concern about pull versus push payments, right? The porn industry, I bet, prefers subscription model, right? And subscription model requires pool model, and Bitcoin is the opposite of that.
But that could come with Lightning, if I understand, could it not?
Yeah, but you still have to maintain a balance in a channel, and there's all kinds of other things. It's, you know, I don't have a lot of hope for pool payments in the cryptocurrency Bitcoin sort of setups, because why would I keep? I mean, maybe there's discount. You know, maybe if you give me a very, very good discount, I will let you deduct. But then, what's the point too? Because of the risk. Then why don't you just pay for the whole year and get the discount, right? You prepay, like VPN or anything like that, right? If you pay for the whole year, you get the discount, and then push is okay. I don't know. It's very unclear to me why these industries are not doing, aside from the pull push issue with subscriptions.
Some of those gray markets you're speaking of.
Exactly. I mean, the black market is, I'm, you know, we don't have a lot of visibility, but I'm certain they're booming because there is a lot of transactions in the network. You know, Bitcoin is doing what it's supposed to do, right? I mean, the whole point of this project was to get out of central banking control over monetary policy and censorship. And it has done that, right? Your Bitcoin HODL is not subjective to QE. And even convolutedly, depending on where you are, you can still spend it. So this Bitcoin experiment, I mean, you know, has accomplished its two main goals. Now it's just a matter of scaling it, right? I think we're never going to be able to compete with credit card points. And credit cards are great. You know, like credit is an important feature of appropriate capital allocation, right?
Yep.
Without credit, you can't build businesses. And I think it's going to be very interesting to see actual good Bitcoin-backed loans and things like that. Right now, the 50% loan-to-value is a joke. I mean, you know, at least give me a shitty mortgage, right? That's what I say to all the guys I know who own these companies. It's like, I want at least a shitty mortgage for my Bitcoin.
The crypto-backed loans?
Yeah. It's like, at least give me, you know, 80 to 90% loan to value and, you know, and a shitty interest rate per year. But 50%, I mean, I'm sorry. That's just ridiculous. I just can't go for that.
Yeah. And then on the other side, I think even the interest rates that are offered, just, you know, just speaking personally, I would need a much, much higher interest rate if I was going to lock up my Bitcoin in one of these companies. That's just me personally.
Yeah.
So it's going to take some time for those spreads to, I think, to adjust. Definitely a lot more trial and error.
Yeah. I mean, also our expectations around shitty mortgages. It's how I like to describe the whole credit industry now.
Sure.
It's completely lopsided, right? Because it's essentially free money. I mean, you'd have to be a sucker to pay off your mortgage in this market, right? It's like, might as well just, you know, put the money in the safest sort of possible investment. You make more interest than the interest you pay in your house. So, you know, and you have the money available to you if you want to pay off the mortgage. So, you know, it's like, it makes no sense. Nothing makes sense right now economically.
Yeah, unfortunately, it's been that way for some time. You're right. But I guess just one question still to follow up on the privacy issue. Definitely, notwithstanding all of the great points you made about, you know, who actually needs Bitcoin, some of the push-pull stuff, and also just, you know, what Bitcoin really is designed for, which I think you eloquently just laid out, even amidst your cold. So you did well there. But still, notwithstanding all of those points, short term, it's in the developed world. Again, I understand these are people that don't necessarily need it. But in the developed world, some of these signs are not so promising. You know, you hear even Binance shutting down withdrawals for someone who mixed coins. You see KYC, AML really ramping up from these sort of centralized exchanges. There is a little bit of positive in that Germany, you know, from this year is actually doing actual Bitcoin banks, amazingly, which is an amazing, I think, countertrend to what we just said. You know, if you can actually hold Bitcoin in a bank account and go back and forth. Again, not at all what we've just been talking about this whole interview. Nonetheless, still with privacy, what do you think it means for the industry if, like, you have a whole swath of regulated, centralized KYC exchanges / banks on the one hand, and then you have just this black market Bitcoin, coin-joined, mixed, private underbelly on the other side? Do you think those worlds ever collide, or they stay separate?
I think they're going to collide in some places. They're going to stay separate in some places. I don't, because Bitcoin is global and also very easy for you to, it's very portable. It's different. I think the concept of the concept of your logic made sense in the gold era, right? So like, pre-Bitcoin, that was true, right? You had the dark markets, the gray markets, and they needed either USD cash or gold or jewelry to sort of move value. And it was tricky, right? It was tricky enough that countries didn't bother to digitalize everything so that they could keep track of everything, right? It was very inefficient for you to bypass capital controls. With Bitcoin, that changed the game. So, you know, when push comes to shove, you can pack your family and travel, right? And go to another place. So if things get bad enough, you can sell your stuff for BTC and leave. So that really throws a wrench in that. And then, you know, countries will try to create more capital controls around their new digital fiats and the wonderful European laws now.
Yep.
It was Directive 5, whatever it was.
Yep.
But I think there is so much you can push that the people take, right? So, you know, an interesting example of that is, like, you know, Germans have never saved as much as they have now, even though there has never been this little interest paid on savings as there is now.
Yeah, which might be a quirk to the country, but yeah.
Yeah. But it's interesting, right? Because people can sense, like they can smell that there is stuff is not right, right? Sure. So they may not be as educated to understand that saving in the bank may not be the smartest thing right now, but they are doing what people do, right? They collect, like it's like the squirrels, they will collect their nuts if the winter is coming, right?
Yeah, and I think they're definitely educated more than most as far as the risks of hyperinflation, for sure.
Exactly. And then, if enough people don't respect the laws really don't become effective, right? It's very hard to enforce them. There is always going to, you're always going to have people be made example of. You're always going to have people on the short end of the stick, right? When you have a very unrespected legal framework.
Yeah.
Like, for example, pot in most countries, right? Like, most countries have pot illegal, but it's incredible the amount of people that smoke pot in most countries.
Right.
So it becomes this thing where, you know, if you are a minority or if you are a less capable part of society, you know, you will be arrested for that crime, right? You will be prosecuted for that crime or hunted for that crime. While if you are in the middle of the spectrum of that population, you know, it's very likely you're never going to encounter any issues, even though you are committing that crime, right? And then, you know, if you are in a more rich part of a population, you essentially don't really have to give a crap about laws in general in most countries. So I don't think that, again, like Bitcoin just amplifies and facilitates, but these things are all just constants in humanity, right? I don't think any of these changes, just because Bitcoin exists, it just becomes more accessible to more people.
Yeah, I think that's a great way to put it. And certainly when, you know, I mentioned like the underbelly of the Bitcoin economy, I mean like the main people that are actually verifying and validating and doing all the transactions they need to do. And like you mentioned, if they need to, they can just pack up and go. But it is interesting to me in the short term how this might turn out. You know, it's accelerating more than it ever has, in my view, but these centralized, regulated, quote unquote, you know, good exchanges and banks and regulations.
But then there is things like BISC, right? Where like they have a decentralized exchange. I think HODL decentralized the exchange too, or in the process of. Again, decentralized systems are always going to be more inefficient, but they're going to be there, right? And if the cost of foregoing all your privacy in your personal calculation is bigger than paying a small 5% premium on a decentralized exchange, well, then you know, you have your answer, right? And what I find fascinating is with a deflationary system, you do have a lot more volatility, right? So, you know, those 5% will be, you're going to have that movement per hour, per day anyways. So, you know, a lot of these things become a wash, right? We see this a lot of our shopping cart system, right? It really is a wash. Some weeks the Bitcoin price is higher. You know, you get Bitcoin at a higher price or a lower price, and you know, it's just the way it is. You know, maybe Bitcoin futures will help sort of a bit with this. And then, you know, there's things like joint markets. Joint market is already exists forever, and it is a fantastic way for you to make your coins have more privacy and mix them. Wasabi and Samurai are other two projects. I'm more interested in what's going to happen with sidechains for privacy because you can have confidential transactions on sidechains, on Liquid Network. So eventually you're going to have, federations that do essentially mixing for you. There's going to be a lot of solutions and a big mix of them. And another thing, too, is that, you know, chain analysis only works to a certain extent as well, right? There's a lot of false positives on that stuff. It's very crude. There is a lot of PR in that because, you know, I'm sure you've dealt with financial institutions before, like in the executive level, right? They couldn't give less of a crap if people are committing crimes or not. What they want to do is just make sure that they follow the standard, even if the standard is stupid, so that, you know, they don't get any liability with regulators. That's all. So chain analysis to me is just that. It's just a check mark that is good enough for the regulators. Then you get your check mark for doing that and you're good to go, right?
I'm in a part of the world where the system definitely didn't care for 20 years, for sure, in banking. There's a lot of Russian money, oligarch money, oil money that came into Europe, rightly or wrongly, that wanted to be, let's say, more safe from the East. And a lot of it was done in Latvian banks, Estonian banks, Lithuanian banks. And I'm seeing it. I'm actually seeing it firsthand where they are now having to pick up the pieces from which everybody, you know, all these Swedish banks, they just love their returns that they were getting in the 90s and the 2000s from these markets. But now it turns out that some of that money may not have been legitimate or whatever, U.S. sanctions coming in, so on and so forth. But I'm really seeing the banks cracking down here.
Yeah, where are these guys going to put all this money? You know, like all this oligarch oil money, because they can't take it back to the East, right? I mean, and it's not like, it's not little bits. So where does this go? That's interesting to me.
You think it goes into Bitcoin?
Bitcoin is too small, right, for this kind of money. You'll get there, but it's too small right now. I mean, I know, it's like, you know, if you're a cartel, you definitely use HSBC for your laundry, right?
Exactly.
they don't need to use coin mixing, right? You just use HSBC.
Right.
It's fascinating because, you know, the size of the gray market, gray financial market is monumental. And it's always going to be, right? Because anybody, any massive corporation, any massive entity that can find some saving or can find a way of skipping either taxes or capital controls will do so, right? It's that's just how the interests are aligned. It's their duty, right? to do this as legally as possible. To really just minimize the legal burden, not necessarily because they care about the morality of it. And I think Bitcoin is uniquely qualified to do that, right? Because it's truly amoral money. There is no way to have your operation chokehold on the Bitcoin space. So I'm very curious to see when this kind of stuff comes in.
Excellent points. Short term, are you... pessimistic, optimistic?
I don't know. I think this experiment has survived 10 years against many different types of actors.
11.
Yeah. I mean, 10 years with like activity and people in it. But yeah, it's like over a decade. And, you know, it's still standing, still good uptime. It's growing. I'm very bullish, very, very bullish on Bitcoin. I think the price conversation is a fun to have one. But the technical bullishness I have right now on Bitcoin is pretty high. There's a lot of stuff going on. The development process, is very grown up now. The way that they're doing the study groups and the research groups around, for example, Schnort is very interesting. A lot of lessons were learned from the SegWit activation.
Yep.
It's fascinating that we won that fork in a massive way, fairly
I wouldn't even say unscathed. We made it as much stronger, right?
Yeah.
I think it really made the Bitcoin ethos more clarified for a lot of people that don't necessarily have the right technical or economic understanding to really understand Bitcoin. At least they got a much better conceptual understanding of it through the fight of it. I mean, it's just incredible to see, right? I mean, like, the Bitcoin is over $7,000. You know, like, I mean, I remember when this thing was about to die at much lower prices.
Not to mention all the obituaries on top of it.
Yeah, you know, it's how many obituaries? There's still people saying it's going to die, which is great. But I find that the level of FUD pre-halvenings really is a good indicator of price movement. When you start seeing a lot of past scammers starting organizations and trying to sort of make moves that are a little bit bigger or more on the social side, like that Nakamoto thing, it's often a good sign. It means that the bad actors are getting hurt on their forks. It means that people are trying to set themselves up for the next run. It's a good sort of sprouting moment of activity.
Yeah, interesting view. So you didn't submit an application for the Nakamoto group?
Yeah, no, I didn't. I'm still running the No Foundation. It just takes too much of my time.
And you were one of the loud vocal ones when the B Foundation, which I think admittedly had pretty much all good actors, but it was a foundation nonetheless. Was announced last year at Honey Badger, 2018. You were one of the loudest opponents of that.
I mean, listen, I always understood the sentiment, right? Like they had good intentions, but the message got lost in the delivery and the setup. I think they would have been a lot more successful in a different model, and that's again like it's. It makes me bullish about effective crypto anarchy, right? Anybody can do anything in this space. Anybody can start anything. Anybody can fork the system. Anybody can do whatever they want. But also anybody can criticize it too.
Yeah.
So you have to really sharpen your tools if you're going to enter the battle of ideas, right? In a crypto and anarchic environment. It really takes a kind of an effort that is asymmetrical and is built that way, right? It takes too much energy to make a small change. You want that to be that way, right? So you cannot have an oppressive minority or an oppressive majority. It's very hard either way. It keeps everybody honest.
Yeah, those are great thoughts. And actually, I wanted to ask you about a tweet that you wrote. I think it was just yesterday. Obviously, we mentioned there's craziness geopolitically in the world. We can't tackle all that on this podcast with everything from Trump to Iran. But you tweeted, "Where were all these protesters when Obama was making it rain in the Middle East with drones? They still aren't protesting against the Assange arrest and WikiLeaks defunding for exposing such murders. Taking political sides is so silly. All the sides use your money for their benefit." I think the statements you just made about Bitcoin probably fit in quite well.
Yeah, it's because it's an incentive. It's an incentive alignment problem, right? I mean, the bureaucracy's incentive is to increase the bureaucracy, right? And there is nothing better than war from any perspective, really, for the bureaucracy. I mean, up until, you know, 60s or 70s, you know, when a country entered a war, there was a lot of suspension of freedoms, right, more overtly. 9/11 changed a lot of that. But now the
the parasitic class, right, politicians, have really honed and improved onto making all this stuff seem seamless, right? So you can have all this stuff from any side of the political spectrum because nobody has your problems in mind there. Everybody's just trying to sell their message to have a job, right? I mean, I don't have to shit on politicians and political systems and democracy in this podcast for this audience. I'm sure I'm just preaching to the choir here. But I found it interesting, right? Like this last, the dichotomy between the Obama and the Trump thing, because, Bush was Bush, but like Obama really took the freedom thing and the remote killing and the executive order count to a whole other level. Like it's a whole other degree of remote killing, right? And then you have Assange, like the guy, don't like the guy. Most people don't like the guy in personal level, but there is this organization that was essentially making all this stuff public. You know, if you're more militaristic, you might have your concerns about how disclosure happens, right? Because it could endanger, military people and stuff. But those guys seem to be fairly responsible in how they did it. And where were all this lefty people who are supposed to be the anti-war people, right? Like cheering and protesting in front of, like taking over streets like they do against war to defend this organization, right? Because I'm pretty certain if there was enough noise, enough protest on all sides, WikiLeaks would have got a lot less hit by this whole thing. Who knows, maybe Assange wouldn't even be in jail. So these people being against a drone strike, I think it was a drone strike, I don't know, maybe it was a jet, whatever it was. The guy was remotely popped on an air base.
Attack, yeah.
Yeah, like on an air base outside of his country. The same way that Obama has been doing for 8 years, right? Like everywhere. The guy literally created like half of the hate for the U.S. By just pissing off a lot of people for making bombs come from the sky. I get the point of the whole hating on the whataboutism, right? Like, yeah, but what about Obama? Yeah, I get that. But this one struck a chord on me because, it was the literal same thing. And people seem to just play team sports now in a degree that was not true before. I don't know, did people get bored with like football and baseball, and now it's just like Trump and the left thing and that's it? It seems that critical thinking has really gone out the window, and Trump it's actually pretty funny to see this whole shit show happening. He's, helping the whole burning the state to the ground. But he did manage to get the troops out of Iraq. I mean, he got Iraq to vote the troop out. So, in either a genius move or a very stupid move, less war, less people in war situations. I don't think any of this stuff is going to get any better anytime soon.
Yeah, and perhaps if he tweets about his hatred for Bitcoin, he'll get even more people interested in that.
Oh, yes, please. Can we get more Bitcoin hate from the president? That would be fantastic. He has a lot of followers.
He does indeed. Rodolfo, this is great, man. Listen, actually, I wanted to pivot back then to one more Bitcoin question. I forgot to ask you this earlier. Kind of like you were mentioning how, might at some level want to be careful about those actors in the military, and if you dox them at the wrong time and so on and so forth, this stuff can get pretty serious in these certainly less than decentralized highest level of politics that we find ourselves in the world today. But bringing it back to like security for a hardware wallet and a Bitcoin. What is your opinion of the best way to responsibly disclose a problem with a bug in a hardware wallet or in some software implementation? We've seen both kinds in Bitcoin, in crypto, certainly in hardware wallets, and even in Bitcoin Core. You know, those wallet.fail guys were made some noise.
I don't think they had proper disclosure anyways. Yeah, those guys were a little bit on the shitty side.
Yeah, and I think I remember actually you mentioning that it wasn't proper. What should people be thinking about and looking at when you're talking about hardware wallet and security disclosure for problems?
Well, the idea in responsible disclosure is being responsible, right? So what would cause least harm to the users is the most important factor, right? So, say you find a bug on a system, right? You reach out to the makers of the system. See, like, it depends on your incentives are too, right? If you're somebody that can contribute to the project, fix the freaking bug or let the maintainers know you're fixing the bug, right? And contribute. It's great. Everybody wins. Sometimes you need to release a fix before you release the details, right? Because you don't want to give bad guys the upper hand. So that's also a type of disclosure, right? Where you release the fix. The problem is in an open source project, it's a little harder, right? Because the bad guys can see the source code, can see the fix. So they can invertly, they can reverse engineer the bug out of that and sort of come up with an attack while people are upgrading. And then there is things like, for example, the Trezor pound, right? Like the Trezor can be essentially ROM dumped in 3 minutes with very cheap hardware, right? So, and it's unfixable. So if you have a Trezor, put a passphrase on it because there is no other security. But in that attack, for example, the incentive was on the competitor that found that flaw to make a PR cycle out of it, right? They were dunking on each other. We recently had a competitor that found a bug in, no, it wasn't really a bug, but they found an exploit they could do against not the hardware wallet itself, but against the partially signed transaction file.
A man in the middle.
They decided to try to get a PR cycle out of it because the company is not doing well. And then they didn't communicate. There was breakdown communication and people decided there is a lot of malicious ways of doing the disclosure for you to get more press for your project. It was cute and all for the last 2 years, but it seems that the users now are more desensitized towards the dunking on competitors. Mm. So they're more interested now, it seems, on competitors just politely and like fixing the bugs and then disclosing what happened and that's it and move on, right? Nothing is fully safe, right? So there's always going to be bugs and things. So it is important to do that.
Is there an easy answer there?
Yeah, the easy answer is, if you found a bug, contact the maintainers, right? Privately, securely. Let them know what the problem is. If you are an actual proper security researcher, you're going to provide a proof of concept to the maintainers, right? So they know exactly what's happening and how you did it. And then in that, they will make a fix. You give enough time for them to release the fix, have the fix picked up by most users, and then you can coordinate the disclosure, like the full disclosure, right, of how it was done, if that's something that's interesting to you. Sometimes it's not. Sometimes you just can't release, you just can't disclose at all because it's unfixable, right? For example, the Trezor problem. Any security researcher that's a little bit more advanced can do the Trezor attack, but most of the good guys won't disclose it because it's unfixable. So they don't want script kiddies being able to do that same attack. But the idea is, you let the people know, and then you coordinate the disclosure. You know, how the PR is going to be played out, how people get paid. These things are all secondary to making sure users are safe, and they should be that way.
Rodolfo, this is great, man. Really a lot of good topics to start out the new year for our anniversary show. Love it. Listen, man, as we close it then, what should our listeners know about you and about ColdCard and everything you're doing?
So we have a Telegram group for ColdCard where a lot of people get a lot of support and community support. We are constantly looking for people to help other users and make help content. It's still quite a bit of a passion project. We are in the process of working on a new product, which is kind of fun too, not releasing too much information about it. But we are putting effort into ColdCard as well. So we should have another few features coming out soon. I think the next feature we're working on is the cosign HSM mode for it. So essentially, you're going to be able to run a piece of software on the computer and have a ColdCard attached to it. And then you log in into that onion address, you upload a PSPT file, and it signs for you. So you can have essentially a cosign service that is your own. So you'd buy, say, two ColdCards, you cosign with them, and one of the cosigning is automated. I'm going to probably have a better explanation of that eventually.
That thing's going to still work with the Mark III?
Yes, it's for the Mark III.
Nice. Can't be going out and buying any more versions of your damn ColdCard.
That's right. No, the other product is not a Mark V or anything like that. It's a different device for different purposes. We think the Mark III is going to stick around for quite some time. It's fairly good and safe. We had to upgrade to the newer secure element because we needed more room and more functionality, and also upgrade the MCU because we needed more memory. But I think we're in a point now that it could remain like this for quite some time. We're not going to make you buy new hardware anytime soon.
Twitter?
Yeah, so you can find us on Twitter. I'm NVK there. And ColdCard Wallet is the other one, and OpenDime and CoinKite. Buy our stuff. That's how you support new developments. And I think that's all I have.
It's just great, man. Rodolfo, it would have been too pretentious of us to start our podcast on January 3rd. So we had to do it on January 9th when Satoshi released the client, which, as you've said twice now on our show, everybody should run, validate. And it's just great to have you on, man. It's a very down-to-earth, non-pretentious person yourself in Bitcoin. Really appreciate everything you guys are doing over there in Canada. Just great to know. It was great to meet you in person at the Honey Badger.
Yeah, thanks, man. It was. It's always a pleasure coming on, being among the base money experts.
I was just going to ask you to watch your base money.
And it was great meeting you guys in person in Riga, and hopefully we'll do it again this year. You know, come by Canada, come say hi. We'll take you guys out. I'm looking forward to the podcast this year.
Thanks. Thanks a lot. Whether it's dollars or loonies or validated Bitcoin, just keep an eye on your base money, my friend. And all the best in 2020.
Take care, man.